Today on Straight Talk Africa, we look at Africa's dynamic and creative youth and their contribution to the development on the continent. In her new book, The Rise of Africa's Small and Medium-Sized Enterprises, or SMES, Ambassador Dr. Robin Rennie-Sanders argues that empowering women, job creation and good governance are keys for sustainable economic growth and development. That's coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters in Washington. I am Shaka Sali.
And hello to all our viewers and listeners on the continent and elsewhere. I'm Ayan Bior, your social media reporter.
Today, it's a discussion on the rise of Africa's small and medium-sized enterprises.
And coming up later, we wanted to know your thoughts on the types of development you would like to see in sub-Saharan Africa. Your emails, Facebook, and Twitter comments poured in, and we'll reveal some of them ahead on Straight Talk Africa.
Africa's creative and innovative young people are really making a huge difference to their communities. My colleague Paul Sisco has more.
Africa's dynamic young people are really making a difference. Some might say they've ignited an economic development revolution that can't be stopped. In her scholarly account, noted international lecturer, writer, and former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria and the Republic of Congo, Robin Rennie-Sanders examines the rise of Africa's small and medium-sized enterprises and the dramatic shift they're now having on sub-Saharan development. She says SMEs are driving development, growth, and more importantly, the continent's middle class. It's a reality. Her friend, colleague, and mentor, former ambassador to the United Nations Andrew Young, believes is long overdue, noting that 40 years of post-independence development approaches have had little impact on reducing overall poverty and creating jobs across the sub-Saharan landscape. Ambassador Sanders says the dynamic entrepreneurial spirit displayed by Africa's Generation X and millennials have formed SMEs and social enterprises responsible for creating the apps, businesses, products, and answers addressing the region's age-old poverty issues. Small and medium enterprises are not only a key driver for jobs, but catalysts for boosting Africa's middle class. Sanders' book further discusses what donors, foundations, and African stock markets are doing to help small and medium enterprises and markets grow, and why, despite poor governance and corruption issues, Africa is still rising. Paul Sisco, VOA News, Washington.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us here in Washington, I expected to be two distinguished guests. One of them, Ambassador Robin Rennie-Sanders, Chief Executive Officer, FEEDS Advocacy Initiative, and author of The Rise of Africa's Small and Medium-Sized Enterprises, Spurring Development and Growing the Middle Class. Well,
thank you.
I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa again.
My pleasure.
You're most welcome. Haramine Sozongbo, international lecturer, researcher, and consultant, is expected to join us shortly. Well, I guess that we have to begin. First of all, to be very honest with you, it's a pleasure not only to have given me the opportunity to read your book, but also to come again and be our guest.
Thank you.
First of all, really, what inspired you? If you were to talk to us from the deepest, bitter part of the bottom of your American heart and soul, why did you write this book?
You know, I always had a passion for how we turn U.S. policy into practical things to do. You can tell people all the things you want to do, but how do you make that practical? How do you make it a reality? And it really started for me in the Congo. I have to say that that is the origins for me of a lot of things, Republic of the Congo, when I served there as ambassador, because it was in that context of a post-conflict country that I wondered what we could contribute as the U.S. government there. And helping the young people there find their way through a small and medium-sized enterprise. They weren't called that then. They were called income-generating projects at that time. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of my wake-up call on how you can actually change the course of someone's life if you give them an opportunity and the means to create their own jobs, create their own livelihoods, and change their own lives. So it was in that context that I became passionate about working on the job creation aspect of development.
But surely, reading your book, I can see, frankly, that you've been almost all over Africa.
Yes.
You had been in other conflict nations. You had been to Namibia.
Mm-hmm.
You had been to Rwanda.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Sudan.
Mm-hmm.
You had been all over the place. Was it because this time around you had the vantage point of being in charge?
I think that it was a combination of both things. I saw, prior to the Congo, sort of the development gaps that were there, things that we weren't doing as the U.S. government, even though we were doing quite a bit. But there were gaps of things that we didn't do, like the vocational training, like making sure that even with our income-generating projects, that people had an opportunity to break off and move off on their own. They didn't need us anymore. We had to transition out of that aid portion of it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was always kind of in the back of my mind and always a struggle for me internally, and certainly coupled with the dynamic of entering a post-conflict country like Congo, it gave me the opportunity to find partners who thought like I did and work with partners in that regard, because certainly I didn't have the resources there to do everything that we were able to accomplish. And so you had to really find like-minded partners. And that also began my interest in public-private partnerships as well.
Talking about partners, talk to us about your UNDP partner,
yes.
A man from Benin who currently happens to be the foreign minister.
Exactly. You know, we both were in the environment there trying to find ways to help the young people who had known nothing but conflict in Republic of Congo because of the length of the war. And so we were able to marshal our resources together to create this very unique educational resource center that included access to computers. It was safe, it was secure, it provided training and workshops. And so that was really a wonderful best practice for me on both the SME side and on the public-private partnership side.
To what extent did that project succeed?
It was extremely successful, and it ran from the time that Mr. Agbenonci, the current foreign minister of Benin, and myself created it with our teams, and it ran, our agreement lasted in, for 10 years. So it ran for that period of time.
Is that what triggered the FEEDS?
No, FEEDS, I think, is a compilation of my entire career in some ways, because it's an acronym meaning food security, education, economics, energy, environment, and development, because all of those things I'm passionate about and all of those things I wanted to find a way to advocate for. And so the idea for the acronym actually comes out of my time in Nigeria,
mm-hmm.
you know, putting all those things together in an acronym that's pronounceable. But those were the areas where I had been passionate about my entire career, and then I wanted to spend my post-career working on those issues.
You were in Nigeria, of course, and you interacted with some people that would be characterized as Oga Patapata.
Okay.
Talk to us about the man you had the opportunity to interact with, and he also happened, in fact, to endorse your book. A man who happens perhaps to be the richest black man on this planet Earth, Aliko Dangote.
Well, I see Mr. Dangote as one of the premier entrepreneurs. When you look at how he began his company, he began with an entrepreneurial effort, and he's a big supporter of entrepreneurs. And, you know, so, you know, watching his work over the years, watching how he began his businesses, and watching how he inspires young people to think about entrepreneurship, I think is extremely important.
He says, of course, he began some kind of small business like 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What exactly was he doing?
I think you probably have to ask him more details about all, you know, how he began his entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. My outreach to him and what I've watched him do is to encourage more young people to look at entrepreneurship as a vehicle for not only changing their lives, but also changing the direction of their country, which is really the premise of the book. When you think about it today, Africa SMEs contribute about 40% to gross domestic product. And what we want to do is make sure that those who have started their small businesses or social enterprises are continuing to do so, so the next generation also does that.
What are some of the most successful part of SMEs? Are we talking about technology? Or are we talking about agriculture? What are we talking about here?
Well, I think that there's a range of sectors that SMEs today are playing a part of. And in the book, I describe this as businesses that are aiding development. I have eight broad categories that I call my top eight list, my tell list. And it really is areas where I see African SMEs or Africa SMEs really making an impact and really making a difference. And so technology is at the base of all of that. All of those sectors or all of those eight things that are on my top eight list are all undergirded by technology. And I really think that it was the combination and the convergence of technology, social media. When you think about when the big entities of social media began, like Facebook and Twitter and all of that, that's still in the 2008-2006 period, the mobility of technology, it had to be mobile for a lot of things that are being done today. And then it really provided what I call the knowledge management. You know, my background is in information systems and tech and communication. And it's having that knowledge in your hand. So you could be a small farmer in West Africa, or you can be a small farmer in Tanzania, and you can know what the price of your goods and services are going to be. You'll be able to do a transaction right there in your hand on your phone. And so all of those things together, in fact, I created a hashtag for it. It's TSMKM. It's technology. It was the convergence with social media. It was the mobility factor. And then it was that knowledge management.
Wouldn't that mean that for you to benefit from that type of technology, you have to be at least reasonably illiterate?
Not necessarily. I mean, you can, I don't know how often you've engaged with people who are not literate, but it doesn't mean that you cannot follow a path to something. And I've worked with people who are not literate. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've worked with small farmers who are not literate. I've worked with a range of people who are not literate from early in my career to later in my career. So I think that sometimes people connect literacy with being smart or not being smart, and that's a false connection.
Correct.
So you have, you know, small farmers that you can give guidance on how to use a feature phone. It doesn't have to be the most sophisticated phone.
Correct.
You have also ways where people can have payments received, cashless payments. So it's not just the pure traditional way of thinking about technology uses. Mm-hmm. And so the creativity that I see out there, particularly with new technologies today, like drones, for example, and 3D printing, I've seen small farmers with the Songhai Project who are not literate, who have learned themselves, you know, how to make spare parts or create local machinery from renewable parts.
Are you still part of the Songhai Project?
Yes.
In Benin, correct?
In Benin, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talk to us about Songhai Project.
Well, I mean, it really is the brainchild of this incredibly talented visionary called Father Nzimonjo. And I worked with him when I was in Congo initially to really help with some of the income-generating projects that we were trying to help many of those coming out of conflict develop. But the Songhai Project is really kind of one of the best examples of how you do everything, not only how you turn or you encourage young people to become farmer entrepreneurs, but it also allows for that talent, that hidden talent of creating local machinery out of the resources that are right there available to you. Mm-hmm. So it's a pretty incredible project.
So it's like a combo.
Yes.
Interesting. Well, before we pause for a short break, we want to remind you that Straight Talk Africa is now streaming on Facebook. Just enter the keyword Straight Talk Africa and watch our show live. And don't forget to share it with your friends. Also, we are on Twitter and we are tweeting live. Follow us at VOA Shaka. That's VOA Shaka. And join in on today's discussion with your questions and comments. Don't forget to use the hashtag VOA Sub-Saharan Africa. We'll put some of your tweets on air later in the show. We'll be right back with you, so please, don't go away.
Touch on things that are important to people on an everyday basis. We hope that our viewers are getting inspired when they watch our show. They're getting a view of the world from a different perspective, things that perhaps are not in their immediate vicinity. Today, I could put in on the show something that is a little different, a little unique, and this gives me that inspiration to come to work.
Like Voice of America on Facebook. Follow VOA on Twitter. Join VOA on our YouTube channel. Like, follow, join VOA.
Today's youth are not just the next generation of African leaders, they are today's leaders. And this is the time to invest in them. Today, not tomorrow. So let's connect, let's engage with each other on issues that will transform our societies.
Innovation, leadership, entrepreneurship, things that you're doing to move the continent forward to make you the greatest generation that Africa has known.
It's Upfront every Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African Beat on The Voice of America. For more information, visit our website at www.voanews.com/African Beat.
Welcome back. Before the break, of course, this is now Haramine Sozongbo, international lecturer, researcher, and consultant. I have to say, madam, that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the pleasure to host you too on Straight Talk Africa.
Pleased to see you again, Shaka.
You're most
and
welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Sorry for the inconvenience. Of course, this is traffic jam time in the nation's capital. So, how are you?
I am fine. What about you?
I am terrific. What can you tell us about SMEs? Small and medium size enterprises.
I mean, there's so much to say about small and medium.
Are they working? Because the author of this great book, Ambassador Dr. Robin Renee Sanders, her argument is they are on the right track and they are making a huge difference, frankly, in the continent.
I would say that indeed a lot's been going on the continent when it comes to SMEs, a lot of improvement. But however, we say that we still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have to compare where we are now to where we have been 10 years ago, 15 years ago, of course, we say that there's a huge improvement.
So what seems to be the problem? What do you think needs to be done so as to improve the status of the SMEs right now on the continent in terms of developing the continent, really?
You know, the issue of the SMEs, the issues are really are big and then can be shared across sectors, private sectors, public sectors, and governments at the government level. So when we look at the SMEs themselves, there's a number of things that needs to be done, such as getting the training that is needed, be ready, having the capital, having the attitude that is needed to conduct business so that the bank can trust you, having the drive to do business and show that you have the collateral so that the bank to secure funding and so forth. But beside that, the government also have a huge responsibility in terms of providing the market, the access that is needed for the small and small medium enterprises to have access to to finances. And by doing that, or by not doing that, there wouldn't be any financial inclusion, there wouldn't be any inclusive development, there wouldn't be any inclusive growth. Yes, like Ambassador, you were saying, right, is on the right path. A lot of African governments are making effort. They recognize that it is important to use the SMEs for the growth, okay, for the growth, development growth. The SMEs is really needed. But they still need to work hard in terms of making them have access to the finances, having great infrastructure for them, because one thing is to have the infrastructure, one thing is to have the money, but if you can take your product from one place to the other, if you can have access to electricity to conduct your business, you can have access to internet to conduct your business, well, there wouldn't be any gain, and most of these business end up being, most of these enterprises end up being enterprises of consumption instead of being one of production that will benefit the economy. So therefore, it is important that they have a greater, develop the infrastructures. And also the market, you know, we have some market. A lot of the people, many people in Africa are in small and medium enterprises. And I believe about 70%, right? 70% of the adult population is invest in small and medium enterprises. But about only 50% of those people have access to finances. So that's really the finance aspect of the things. But we're talking about also the market. Mm-hmm. You know, some of the market where a lot, you will find a lot of the women. So I will talk about, again, the gender. I will be talking about women issues. Yeah, they need to look at the gender disparities.
That is very interesting because she actually raises that issue in her book.
Okay, I didn't have the chance to read the book, but, you know, it's my subject area. I'm always on it when it comes to gender issues because the disparity is huge. I was born and raised on the continent, and I know what it is like. I experience it, and then after my studies, I go back and everything. I still see it. It's still there. And so a lot needs to be done when it comes to gender disparities. Market access, some of the market that where people can use, they're really underdeveloped. Some of them are just very old, and they're just like markets of the colonial time. So a lot needs to be done on that level also. And also, I'm talking about the rights, the legal right of the people to have to know what they right when they're doing business. That is, and then also we always talk about the one-point shop, you know, where you can, the government make this available to the SMEs owners to make it easy for them to have access, to know what to do in terms of getting access to finance, in terms of conducting business, in terms of making their business prosper.
So basically you're talking about governments providing what they call an enabling environment.
Correct.
Also perhaps providing infrastructure and also some legal framework, especially when it comes to women. You raised the point that, for example, in Africa, when it comes to agriculture, the women are the champions.
Sure.
They are the single largest producer when it comes to food and what have you, and yet they don't have control. So, prescription.
Yes, you know, it's very interesting how your comments dovetail quite a bit. I have a chapter that talks about the access to financing mm-hmm. issue and really making recommendations on non-traditional ways to look at access to financing. Mm-hmm. There are new methods out there as to how they do valuation of companies. Some use social media. There's an entity called Contable that's looking at other ways to value companies. You know, one of the biggest shocking figures in that I found in the research was that the financing gap for women worldwide, not just for Africa, but African women represent a good chunk of that. It's something like $285 billion.
Wow.
I mean, that's an incredible financing gap. So I'm not arguing for traditional financings per se, even though that's useful, but I think for a lot of SMEs and social enterprises, other types of creative financing needs to be done. On the side of governments, I also talk about that as well. One of the things that was stark to me as doing the research is really only 3 to 4 countries in sub-Saharan Africa mm-hmm. that have ministries of small and medium-sized enterprises, standalone ministries, mostly.
And those are?
Those are South Africa just started its at the end of 2016, I believe in November 2016.
Mm-hmm.
Republic of Congo, mm-hmm. my old stomping ground, has one mm-hmm. as well. And then Liberia also has legislation that accounts for a certain percentage of government procurement and other things being dedicated to SMEs. So what I do call for in the book is a U.S. SBA-like entity in countries so that all the resources, all of the efforts for training get marshaled by one entity as opposed to being subsumed under a trade ministry or something like that. If you even look at the U.S. case, we only began the U.S. SBA, the United States Small Business Administration, in 1956.
Yeah.
But look how long we were an industrialized country before then. So it even took us a long time to get our act together on that. So on recommendations that are in the book, that's one of the things that I strongly recommend is that sub-Saharan African countries really look at creating within their cultural environment context and their government leadership some kind of standalone entity that it's its own ministry for small and medium-sized enterprises.
Sort of untraditional means of funding some of these projects. Would you think, for example, about something like, is it microfinance?
Yeah, microfinance, to me, in a way, it's all microfinance in a way. If you're looking at SMEs, the other challenge that was very stark in the research was how SMEs are being defined. And particularly here in the U.S., when I talk about Africa, it was one of the things that I went back and forth with my copy editors on. They wanted to change the word to African SMEs, but I say Africa SMEs, and that's not a typo. And
what's
it's not
the difference?
To me, the difference is it's all inclusive because mm-hmm. you have the diaspora playing a role,
mm-hmm.
You have SMEs on the continent playing a role, and you have people that self-define themselves as linked to both continents, you know, whether it's in the Caribbean, whether it's in the U.S., what have you. So it includes nationals, immigrants, and the diaspora. So I wanted the
so
more
in a
global
way is to put the diaspora
exactly,
also
right,
as part
right,
of
as part
the
of that
okay.
because that I know that that's I work with diaspora groups I know that's part of it so it is the big tent
picture.
Africa that I wanted to encapsulate in this.
Sort of
but
holistic.
Talking about the SMEs,
yes.
talking about the funding when you talk about microfinances, yeah. I think yes, it is microfinances. We've been having that in different governments where they're making mm-hmm. this effort to provide some. Most of the time, they're just on the smaller scale.
Very small.
Because, mm-hmm. and then some of the limits are just like $10,000. Mm-hmm. You can go beyond that. And then from there, you have the bigger enterprises that are getting something from
right.
500,000 to 1,000 to 1 million and so on and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So we need something in between. In between the microfinances group and then, so which
right,
is
exactly.
what you were talking about
exactly.
earlier, we need mm-hmm. something like that
right.
to make it more inclusive mm-hmm. for everybody because not every small and medium enterprises deserve the same amount of...
Exactly.
Unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. You're tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment. including our social media segment. So please, don't go away. Welcome back to Straight Talk Africa, live from Washington. It's time to bring in my colleague and media reporter, Ayen Bior. Take it away, Ayen.
Thanks, Shaka. On Tuesday, I attended a global business risk forum here in Washington and learned that cyber liability was the top cause of financial loss for manufacturing organizations across the globe. Losses suffered by manufacturing businesses due to risks relating to political violence was second. While economic powerhouses such as the U.S. and China continue to dominate the construction market, much of the growth in this industry is coming from Africa and the Middle East, where developing economies have a greater demand for buildings and infrastructure. Expanding infrastructure projects on the continent was a reoccurring concern for a lot of our social media followers. People want to see more urban development, more schools and hospitals being built in their home countries. In a moment, we'll reveal your Twitter comments to see what your thoughts and concerns are about development in Africa. The future of sub-Saharan Africa's development lies in the hands of its youth, as Africa's growth and progress is being driven by small and medium-sized enterprises. This leads us to our question of the week, which asks, what type of development would you like to see in sub-Saharan Africa? Well, before we begin, I'd like to thank all of you for using our social media platforms to communicate with us. And another reminder that we are tweeting live today. Use the hashtag VOA Sub-Sahara Africa. And if you haven't yet, please follow us at VOA Shaka. And speaking of it, let's go to a tweet from Yusuf Lims, who says, Africa needs more manufacturing industries so that its raw materials are not exported to other continents. It will be better for Africa. We have another tweet from Prospero who says, in Africa, we mostly depend on the government for peace and security, which they fail to maintain to much extent. What else? Very interesting. Well, now to our comment of the week from Facebook fan Victoria Jodale in Nigeria, who says, among the developments I would like to see are road networks linking rural areas to urban areas, fully equipped hospitals, proper drainage systems, modern markets, aggressive tree planting, and quality water facilities to connect communities instead of the individual boreholes that we have now. We are drinking filtered sewage water every day. Urban and regional planning must be put into action. Well, let's go to another comment from Facebook fan Onyat Benedict, who writes, because so many farmers rely on small plots of land for their food and income, African governments must invest more on irrigation systems. And our last Facebook comment comes from Vincent Utuma. He says, I would like to see human development before any other form of development. I would also like to see a drastic reduction in poverty. Peace in the region is paramount to achieving our aspirations and goals. Well, thank you, Vincent, for that optimistic note. Now, a reminder that we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Please keep them coming. And if you're a new fan, drop us a line at africatv@voanews.com. Once again, our email address is africatv@voanews.com or post your comment on our Facebook page. Enter the keywords Straight Talk Africa. Interact with our show as it's streaming live. Be sure to visit us online at voaafrica.com or you can join our YouTube channel. Sign up to VOA TV 2 Africa and follow us on Twitter at VOA Shaka. A reminder that the show is streaming live every Wednesday. Go to VOA Straight Talk Africa TV program page on our website. Or simply watch us live on your mobile device. Just download the VOA mobile app. Now let's take a look at what's on tap for next week's program. On the next Straight Talk Africa, what does the future hold for Liberia? Who will lead the West African nation when President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf leaves office in October at the end of her second term? 2 million Liberians have registered to vote, and nearly half of those are women. What's at stake in Liberia? On the next Straight Talk Africa. Well, Shaka, as you can see, there certainly is no shortage of opinions and ideas on our social media pages. What's your take?
Well, thank you very much, Ayen, for sharing some social media reactions with us. And welcome back to our discussion on the rise of Africa's small and medium-sized enterprises. Our distinguished guests are Ambassador Dr. Robin Renee Sanders, Chief Executive Officer Feeds Advocacy Initiative, and Haramine Sozongbo, International Lecturer, Researcher, and Consultant. Ladies, I have to say once again that I am profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Your reaction. You had, of course, the reaction of social media. Mm-hmm. How do you react?
You know, the sectors that I have on my top eight lists are fairly broad. Manufacturing is one, infrastructure is another. There's services, because there's so many opportunity in services, and I define services quite broadly. It includes also services in agriculture. It includes services to have climate change smart activities, because when you look at what the UN is saying and other entities, you know, tourism is going to be a big opportunity for mm-hmm. growth, and so that's a big opportunity for SMEs like manufacturing. But one of the recommendations that I came up with as well is finding ways to have a big business or even larger size businesses and small businesses work together. The special economic zones, the industrial clusters, are ways to do that. Mm-hmm. That group in the middle, I call the critical mass group, actually, because it's so important that critical mass group, and it's anywhere between someone making, you know, $10,000 annually to about $200,000 to $250,000 annually. They are a fragile group because any major life change could send them back below the poverty line. So it's that group that is, to me, where a lot of effort needs to be done so that they remain securely where they are, and then we can help the next tranche. But the main challenge, I think, is how SMEs are defined, not just on the continent, but certainly here. The definitions are all over the map. Mm. Sometimes it's by capitalization, sometimes it's by valuation, sometimes it's by number of employees. And I think that because you have this wide range of definitions, their ability to access financing gets impacted by that. And so I think that some kind of holistic strategy, I actually call it the Africa SME strategic plan, needs to be put in place so that everyone is talking about the same thing under the same terms, so that you're able to really help this critical mass group of SMEs and social entrepreneurs, which the bulk are women,
correct,
to actually move and stay in the middle class, so you don't have this fragility that's there with this group that's in between.
Mm-hmm. So what about what you characterize as quote fragile and quote end of Africa's middle class?
Right. I call that the fragile middle class because, you know, as you are in that $10,000 to $250,000 a year range, you are fragile because anything that could happen, whether it's a natural disaster or a family crisis, could send you back below the poverty line.
And also political reasons.
Because a lot
of the people who are in the middle class, either they're doing business
or
they have the political situation
also
that plays into
that. So
when the government
collapses,
mm-hmm. then it is fragile,
absolutely.
Like you said.
Talking about politics, what about the issue really of governance?
Mm-hmm. I have a whole chapter on governance because that's really important.
I saw, for example, where among other things, you say they are more evolving and maturing democracies on the continent, correct?
Yes.
Even though much still needs to be done to address poverty and improve social sector issues like food security, health, and education, with some countries continuing autocratic rule, non-transparent political processes, and restrictions on human rights and press and social media freedoms. You give some 9 countries here. One is Zimbabwe, Democratic Republic of Congo, Angola, Cameroon. You give both Sudans, Khartoum, of course, and Juba. You have Equatorial Guinea and Gabon. What was your methodology really that you used to arrive at these 9 countries?
You know, the book is really written from my experience, and you know, I've had experience across the board with those countries. Others may put other countries on the list, but I really think that history has borne out, if you look at today, that those countries are struggling with those issues. If you look at what's happening in Cameroon today, you look at what's happening in Angola, you certainly look at what's happening with DRC, whether or not there's going to be an election or not.
You can't call them democracy, obviously.
I didn't call them democracy.
No, of course, I see what you mean. But then someone might ask you, how come you left out, for example, Congo-Brazzaville? How come you left out Eritrea, Ethiopia, Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, Congo? Of course, I said Congo-Brazzaville. Zambia, you see what is happening there. Mm-hmm. Uganda and Chad, to name others.
Well, if you look at all aspects of the book, I talk about giving you illustrative examples. When you get to the end of the book, I have a series of countries that are on my watch list, and the ones that you mentioned are actually on that watch list toward the end of the book, because, you know, you just had an election in Zambia. You need to see how that still progresses. And you just had some other changes. Even in South Africa is on my concern list.
What about Uganda? You know, where it's
or
from?
Uganda, exactly.
Why so did you put look Uganda at, toward the end?
It's a list of things that are countries that are on my watch list.
I think thanks to God, South Africa still has strong institutions, including an independent judiciary. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which you probably wouldn't really assign to some of these countries.
But, I mean, the problem is that we have I'm sorry to say that, but we have a dying political class in those countries. You know, it's there are people who have been there for so many years, and there haven't been very much of innovation when you refer to those specific countries you're talking about. And so we need a boost, economic boost, and I usually refer to it like we need an economic Viagra in Africa. We don't need leaders who are taking Viagra, need economic Viagra. So leaders who are there to really boost the economy, and like the CEO of Alibaba say, when you turn 50, between 50 and 60, you have to invest in the youth, and that's lacking a lot. And the youth, actually, is needed for the economic growth, for economic development, and they are the power for tomorrow.
Do you think there is a choice, really? Because there are those two key things. One, social media, and the changing demographics.
Yeah, and clearly the changing demographics are there. You know, if I wanted to have a 1,000-page book, I could list every country. Mm-hmm. I was providing sort of a framework of examples because it's important to sort of note where some of the challenges are, which is really some of the countries that remain autocratic. But also the ones that I am watching closely, I actually talk about, you know, what they possibly could do to better help their SMEs, even if they are an autocratic entity.
Do you think the government, the way they are now, even if do you think they will follow the advice you will be giving them or the advice you give them in the book?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things, the book is about SMEs. It's not about every issue on the continent. That would be more than you could put in one book. But you know, Congo does have a very vibrant ministry of small and medium-sized enterprises.
It can have a ministry.
Right.
The question is, does it deliver?
Yes, I know
you
the
have
minister.
Countries, for example, which have ministries of ethics and integrity.
Sure, you're absolutely right.
And implementation. Yet, at the end of the day, you find that they are probably more corrupt
right.
than countries which do not pretend to have a ministry.
I don't disagree with that.
The book and how people are applying it to reality. So we need to work on that as well.
Sure.
To see, you know, to follow up with what is in the Constitution, what is in the book, and what is said.
And what is implemented.
Unfortunately, exactly. There's no democracy in Studio 52. A reminder that you are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll continue our discussion in a moment, so please, don't go away.
If you liked today's show, please write and tell us what you think or give us some suggestions. Be sure to tell us what station you're tuned into. Our address, Straight Talk Africa, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. Or send us an email at africatv@voanews.com. Log on to our website at voaafrica.com. Or post your comments on Facebook, keywords Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther Gizie Ewart. And of course, this is Straight Talk Africa coming to you live from Washington. Do you really think that you can have the SMEs succeed in an environment that does not adopt policies that reflect social economic justice for all?
Well, my experience has been, and I've been in several conflict countries where I believe, and the SMEs that I have worked have thrived in environments that you wouldn't think they can thrive in. And so when I talk about the rise of SMEs, I'm not saying it is a neutral environment where everything is a utopia and so therefore you can rise. The reason that it's termed that way is that they are surviving despite the odds. You know, and so, yes, you can give examples across the board in sub-Saharan Africa where you have autocratic environments, you have conflicts. You know, one of the big lessons out of Congo for me was how particularly women income-generating projects survived against incredible odds of post-conflict scenarios. Some of the graphs that are in the book that's based on data from Gallup World Polls shows that even in post-conflict countries like Somalia, like Sierra Leone, even in difficult environments like Ethiopia, African SMEs, the nationals there are still saying that to start a business is still what they want to do. Mm. And they want to do it against all of the odds that might be there on governance, on all the other issues. And a lot of them are surviving because they're doing just that.
Mm.
So yes, you don't always have to have a perfect environment, but I really have admired the tenacity of the average SMEer to do things against all odds that are there. We want the framework to be there. You're absolutely right. I talk about the frameworks of governance. I talk about the anti-corruption issue and transparency.
Political stability.
And stability and conflict. But the African millennials in particular are doing things against those odds. They're still starting their small business. And they're either hiring, you know, either they're a sole proprietor or they're hiring one or two other people. And just that fact alone helps them have a different quality of life.
But the issue that I see with that is once the environment is not stable enough for them to conduct the business, it is also difficult for them to go and ask for credit.
Mm-hmm.
So they usually go with their own capital, the cash that they have. And at the end, a lot of those end up being small businesses and contributing only for the domestic consumption, while we are looking at more of enterprises that can also
contribute to the economic growth of the continent or the country where
they live in. I wasn't just looking at that, because I think that, particularly since I've lived in conflict environments, you have to give space and credit to those people who are trying to manage their own domestic consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Because
definitely,
the alternative,
because
the alternative
could have been afraid
tough.
And
exactly.
going to hide, mm-hmm. but you know they have to survive.
Sure.
Like you were saying, you were
mm-hmm.
talking about survival. Mm-hmm. You know, they have to survive, which is what many of them are doing, because despite, against all the odds,
sure.
they still go out there and sell things on the market, and it's impressive
right.
how
I respect
those,
that.
Yeah, no, I really, I do mm-hmm. myself, because you will feel like there should be.
But there is a limit to what an individual or individuals can do, and obviously what a government can do, or a foundation, or a huge energy, or a cooperative, or something of that sort. You know as well as I do that Africa missed out of the Industrial Revolution.
Oh, yeah, that's a long time ago.
What does Africa now need to do sincerely to make sure that it does not miss out of this high-tech revolution? Because when I was born and growing up, I was told and I experienced that we basically consumed, for example, what we did not produce and produced what we did not consume.
Mm-hmm.
And I think things, frankly, to have changed.
Mm-hmm.
You have all these minerals on the African continent, but where do you get the all these gadgets, iPhones and stuff like that? China, United States, Europe, not Africa. When does Africa wake up and begin to add value, really, to its raw commodities, raw materials?
You see that beginning in a few countries where, you know, South Africa has a number of industrial plants. You see that beginning in places like Rwanda and Tanzania. You even see it in Congo Brazzaville, where they're making different electronics.
Yeah,
so it's beginning in Nigeria as well.
Actually, this young man in Congo Brazzaville, I think, who has something to do with computers.
Well, there are a number of examples across the continent. That was what was so amazing to me,
yeah.
that you know, how people are using drones for development, delivering medicine. You know, how they're using 3D printing to create their own spare parts.
Exactly. Car building.
Exactly. And the first drone was manufactured on the continent,
really?
In Kenya. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
a couple of months
really?
Ago. Yes, mm-hmm. by a young entrepreneur. So it is happening, and so there is this rise that you see, but it doesn't diminish the challenges that are there. But concurrently with the challenges, I think we as advocates need to continue to encourage African governments and even donor governments to look at this critical sector that we're mm-hmm. talking about so that they're not fragile. And I think to me that is really one of the most important things.
You know, you focused on what you call sub-Sahara Africa. I keep hearing this expression, especially from the United States of America, referring to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Again, when I was a kid growing up in Kabale, southwestern Uganda, going to primary school, we used to talk about the best of something in Africa, south of the Sahara and north of Limpopo.
Mm-hmm.
But those boundaries don't exist anymore.
Mm-hmm.
All these countries, you know, south of Limpopo, south of, North Africa, whatever, they are, the last time I checked, they are all member states of mm-hmm. the African Union.
I'm talking about my area of expertise, which is not in the northern tier of the continent.
Mm.
So in order to be an honest broker in the book, that's why I completely say at the very beginning that I am going to focus on sub-Saharan Africa, because that's where my experience...
You focus on something you can manage.
Yeah. Yes, well, that's where my expertise and my expertise
yeah.
is. And so it would not be fair to do it in places where I haven't lived and I haven't served.
And I'm really glad that you brought that up, because more and more people just refer to Africa as sub-Saharan Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And this has been in many books for so long, because a lot of people who start doing some work in Africa, they mostly just focus on the sub-Saharan Africa. But the people in the northern part of Africa also more and more recognize that there's a lack. And now they have the Egypt, there was a conference that is going on, that's going on now, is in Egypt every year now.
Uh-huh.
They have the Egyptian conference about investors in Africa, just to let people know that Africa, you know, whether it's Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, and all those, they are also part of Africa. They may be close to the Mediterranean, but they're still part of Africa, and they consider themselves African.
But these attitudes can die very, very, very hard, to tell you the truth, because I remember several years ago, I was in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, and we were having a discussion, and this gentleman, the Egyptian brother, said that he had just come in from Africa. And I said, so from Africa, which part are you talking about? He said he had just come in from Nairobi in Kenya. And I said, but the last time I checked, you Egyptians are very, very proud of the fact that you are the African champion soccer team.
But you see that not only in Northern Africa. You see that not only in Northern Africa, because that's how this dynamic has been for a long time. And there's a need to change that dialogue.
Correct.
To make people understand that the northern part of Africa is still part of the sub-Saharan Africa. And as I'm saying earlier, it doesn't happen only in the northern part of Africa. People from Congo will go and play in Ethiopia, and then the Ethiopian people will say, oh, look at the Congo, the African people.
They are
the one playing on the other team.
Correct.
Meaning that the Ethiopians are not African. That's in East Africa. That's in sub-Saharan Africa.
There was a time when people flew from Addis Ababa going to Nairobi or Entebbe, and they said they were going to Africa.
Exactly.
But at the State Department, where you cut your teeth, they still have North Africa somewhere else.
Yeah, it's in the different. Well, I think that we've looked at that for many, many years in state, and I do think that hopefully the new administration will take a look at that again. Mm. But you know, that being said, there are a couple of examples out of Egypt that are in the book. But when I talk about the impact that I think SMEs are making in sub-Saharan Africa, the main focus really is to look at, you know, how you impact the GDP of a particular country, how you impact the GDP of the continent. And I do talk about the continent, the continental trade market framework that the African Union is hoping to launch at the end of this year or the beginning of next year, where it brings all of Africa's market under one umbrella, which I think is a wonderful opportunity. So that will include North Africa as well. And then the other aspect, of course, I think we all recognize that the African Union is an entire body, and then you've had, I believe it's Morocco that's coming back.
Correct.
Come back after so many years into the African Union. So, you know, it's not excluding North Africa, but when I give you concrete, realistic examples, they come from my time in sub-Saharan Africa.
We still consider, for example, Dr. Boutros Ghali as the first African UN Secretary General, correct? Mm-hmm. And when you were in the Nuba Mountains,
yes.
Did you feel like you were in Africa?
Yes, of course.
Tell us, you are launching this book.
Yes.
Tomorrow?
Yes, tomorrow at Gallup.
You have 30 seconds.
I have 30 seconds, okay. Well, you're both invited, first of all. The book will be launched at Gallup World Poll headquarters in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. That will be the first launch of the hard copy book. The soft copy has been out for a couple of weeks. And it was an offer by Gallup to do so. I have a working partnership with them, and a lot of their data is in the FEES index that I produce every year. And what that did was provide
10 seconds.
The enabling environment under which African SMEs work, and it talks about all of these issues that we've talked about already.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
You're most welcome. On that note, thanks to our distinguished guests, Ambassador Dr. Robin Rene Sanders and Hameen Zozongbo. Thanks to our affiliate stations, along with our viewers and listeners, we thank you for tuning in. For many of our Voice of America radio affiliates, Learning English is coming up next. And tomorrow morning, Daybreak Africa with James Bate. On behalf of the Voice of America, thanks for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive.